Penguin Random House Audio presents The Armour of Light, a novel by Ken Follett, read for you by John Lee. This book is dedicated to the historians. There are many thousands of them all over the world. Some sit in libraries, hunched over ancient manuscripts, trying to understand dead languages in mysterious hieroglyphs. Others kneel on the ground sifting earth on the sites of ruined buildings, seeking fragments from lost civilizations. Yet more read through interminably dull government papers dealing with long-forgotten political crises. They are relentless in their search for the truth. Without them, we would not understand where we come from, and that would make it even more difficult to figure out where we're going. Cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armour of light. Romans, chapter 13, verse 12. Part 1. The Spinning Engine, 1792 to 1793. Chapter 1. Until that day, Sal Clitheroe had never heard her husband scream. After that day, she never heard it again, except in dreams. It was noon when she got to Brookfield. She knew the time by the quality of the light gleaming weakly through the pearl-grey cloud that sheeted the sky. The field was 4 flat acres of mud, with a quick stream along one side, and a low hill at the south end. The day was cold and dry, but it had rained for a week, and as she splashed through the puddles, the sticky sludge tried to pull off her homemade shoes. It was hard going, but she was a big, strong woman, and she did not tire easily. 4 men were harvesting a winter crop of turnips, bending and lifting and stacking the knobbly brown roots on broad, shallow baskets called corves. When a corve was loaded, the men would carry it to the foot of the hill and tumble the turnips into a stout oak 4-wheeled cart. Their task was almost done, Sal saw, for this end of the field was bare of turnips and the men were working close to the hill. They were all dressed alike. They wore collarless shirts and homespun knee breeches made by their wives, and waistcoats bought second-hand or discarded by rich men. Waistcoats never wore out. Sal's father had had a fancy one, double-breasted, with red and brown stripes and braided hems, cast off by some city dandy. She had never seen him in anything else, and he had been buried in it. On their feet, the labourers had hand-me-down boots, endlessly repaired. Each man had a hat, and all were different. A cap of rabbit fur, a straw cartwheel with a wide brim, a tall felt hat, and a tricorn that might have belonged to a naval officer. Sal recognized the fur cap. It belonged to her husband, Harry. She had made it herself, after she had caught the rabbit and killed it with a stone and skinned it and cooked it in a pot with an onion. But she would have known Harry without the hat, even at a distance, by his ginger beard. Harry's figure was slender but wiry, and he was deceptively strong. He loaded his corf with just as many turnips as the bigger men. Just looking at that lean, hard body at the far end of a muddy field gave Sal a little glow of desire inside, half pleasure and half anticipation, like coming in from the cold to the warm smell of a wood fire. As she crossed the field, she began to hear their voices. Every few minutes, one would call to another, and there would be a short exchange ending in laughter. She could not make out the words, but she could guess what they were saying. It would be the mock-aggressive banter of working men, jovial insults and cheerful vulgarity, pleasantries that relieved the monotony of repetitive hard work. A fifth man was watching them, standing by the cart, holding a short horsewhip. He was better dressed, with a blue tailcoat and polished black knee boots. His name was Will Riddick. He was 30 years old, and he was the eldest son of the Squire of Badford. The field was his father's, as were the horse and cart. Will had thick black hair cut to chin length, and he looked discontented. She could guess why. Supervising the turnip harvest was not his job, and he felt it was beneath him. But the Squire's factor had fallen ill, and Sal guessed that Will had been drafted in to replace him, unwillingly. At Sal's side, her child stumbled barefoot across the boggy ground, struggling to keep pace with her, until she turned and stooped and picked him up effortlessly, then walked on with him in one arm, his head on her shoulder. She held his thin, warm body a little tighter than she needed to, just because she loved him so much. She would have welcomed more children, but she had suffered 2 miscarriages and a stillbirth. She had stopped hoping and had begun to tell herself that, poor as they were, 1 child was enough. She was devoted to her child, probably too much so, for children were often taken away by illness or accident, and she knew that that would break her heart. She had named him Christopher, but when he was learning to talk, he had mangled his name to Kit, and that was what he was called now. He was 6 years old, and small for his age. Sal hoped that he would grow up to be like Harry, slim but strong. He had certainly inherited his father's red hair. It was time for the midday meal, and Sal was carrying a basket with cheese, bread, and 3 wrinkled apples. Some way behind her was another village wife, Annie Mann, a vigorous woman the same age as Sal. 2 more on the same errand were approaching from the opposite direction, down the hill, baskets on their arms, children in tow. The men stopped work gratefully, wiping their muddy hands on their breeches and moving toward the stream where they could sit on a bed of grass. Sal reached the path and let Kit down gently. Will Riddick took a watch on a chain from his waistcoat pocket and consulted it with a scowl. "It's not noon yet," he called out. He was lying, Sal felt sure, but no one else had a watch. "Keep working, you men," he ordered. Sal was not surprised. Will had a mean streak. His father, the squire, could be hard-hearted, but Will was worse. "Finish the job, then have your dinners," he said. There was a note of disdain in the way he said, "your dinners," as if there was something contemptible about labourers' meals. Will himself would be going back to the manor house for roast beef and potatoes, she thought, and probably a jug of strong beer to go with it. 3 of the men bent to their work again, but the 4th did not. He was Ike Clitheroe, Harry's uncle, a grey-bearded man of about 50. In a mild tone, he said, "Better not overload the cart, Mr. Riddick. You leave it to me to be the judge of that." "Begging your pardon," Ike persisted, "but that brake is about worn through." "There's nothing wrong with the damned cart," Will said. "You just want to stop work early. You always do." Sal's husband spoke up. Harry was never slow to join in an argument. "You should listen to Uncle Ike," he said to Will. "Otherwise you could lose your cart and your horse, and all your bloody turnips too." The other men laughed, but it was never wise to have a joke at the expense of the gentry, and Will frowned blackly and said, "You shut your insolent mouth, Harry Clitheroe." Sal felt Kit's little hand creep into her own. His father was getting into a conflict, and young Kit sensed the danger. Insolence was Harry's weakness. He was an honest man and a hard worker, but he did not believe the gentry were better than him. Sal loved him for his pride and his independent thinking, but the masters resented it, and he was often in trouble for insubordination. However, he had made his point now, and he said no more, but went back to work. The women put down their baskets on the bank of the stream. Sal and Annie went to help their men gather turnips, while the other 2 wives, who were older, sat with the dinners. The work was finished quickly. At that point, it became obvious that Will had made a mistake in leaving the cart at the foot of the hill. He should have stationed it 50 yards farther down the track, to give the horse room to pick up speed before tackling the slope. He thought for a moment, then said, "You men, push the back of the cart to give the horse a start." Then he jumped up on the seat, deployed the whip, and said, "Hup!" The grey mare took the strain. The 4 labourers got behind the cart and pushed. Their feet slipped on the wet path. The muscles of Harry's shoulders rippled. Sal, who was as strong as any of them, joined in. So did little Kit, which made the men smile. The wheels shifted, the mare lowered her head and leaned into the traces, the whip cracked, and the cart moved. The helpers fell back and watched as it headed up the slope. But the mare slowed, and Will yelled back, "Keep pushing!" They all ran forward, put their hands on the tail end of the cart, and resumed. Once again, the cart picked up speed. For a few yards, the mare ran well. Powerful shoulders straining against...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?